This is Culturetopia, your weekly roundup of the very best arts and culture stories from NPR. I am Neda Ulaby. Just a reminder, you can, as always, subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. This week, Leonardo DiCaprio discusses finding a way through the multi-layered dream world of his new film, Inception. The new book, California Schemin', tells how a Scottish-born musician led a double life as an American rapper. And Live Nation stumbles with low ticket sales and canceled shows as the summer concert season begins. But first,
writer Harvey Pekar was found dead this morning at his home in Cleveland. He immortalized that city in his work, which critics compared to that of Chekhov and Dostoevsky. The cause of death is not yet known, but Pekar suffered from prostate cancer, among other ailments. He was 70 years old. NPR's Neda Ulaby reports.
He was a schlub, as ordinary as a pair of old twill pants, the sort of thing he usually wore. But Harvey Pekar translated his life into art, comic books, plays, an opera, even a movie.
So it's a few months later, and I'm working my flunky file clerk gig at the VA hospital. My voice still ain't back yet.
Thank you, Harvey, dear.
Things seem like they can't get any worse.
The 2003 film, American Splendor, adapted Harvey Pekar's autobiographical comic series of the same name. It revealed a darkly prosaic life, yelling at old ladies in the supermarket, losing his keys, and feeling rejected and alone.
I don't mind it if I show myself being cheap or being, you know, unreasonable sometimes. At least I haven't killed anybody.
Harvey Pekar on WHYY's Fresh Air in 2005. He started writing American Splendor in 1976, convinced, he said, that every life holds interest, even one defined by chronic underemployment, grouchiness, collecting old records, and trading postcards with a tiny group of followers, lovers and haters.
People say, get a life. Well, I mean, that was part of my life. You know, it was a social connection. Other than that, I really didn't have too much. I would just get up and go to work and come home.
Dear Mr. Pekar.
One of Harvey Pekar's correspondents was a woman, played by Hope Davis in the movie, who taught writing to prisoners.
I try to help them build an interior life and make art out of their monotonous, suffocating routine.
Joyce Brabner and Harvey Pekar got married on their third date. Their shared story became creative fodder, his struggle with cancer, her political activism, and it inspired a new generation of graphic novelists.
He was huge.
Glenn Weldon writes on comic books for NPR's website, and he says Pekar never drew his own comics. Instead, the writer collaborated with artists, including the legendary underground figure R. Crumb.
He's lumped in with Crumb all the time because Crumb was his really first illustrator, but he shares none of Crumb's love of excess or kinkiness. He's a very practical, prosaic guy who gets angry about everyday things. He gets angry about the way that workers are treated in Cleveland. He gets angry about local government.
It was anger that got Harvey Pekar kicked off as a regular on The Late Show with David Letterman. He yelled at the host about the corporate malfeasance of NBC's owner, General Electric. Letterman retaliated on air.
So what?
You're not coming back.
If I was a file clerk,
you're a dork,
you...
Harvey, relax.
Pekar's refusal to compromise, his intractability, meant he never got rich. His priorities were different.
I'm trying to get every man involved in art, into experimental music, or painting, or novel writing.
Or graphic novel writing. What mattered most to Harvey Pekar was that people appreciate their own latent abilities, the power of the everyday. Ordinary life, he liked to say, is pretty complex stuff. Neda Ulaby, NPR News. Leonardo DiCaprio's new movie, Inception, is many things, but simple is not one of them. He plays Dom Cobb, a professional safecracker, only he's trying to steal secrets from someone's mind. For a price, he will drug a high-powered CEO, slip into his dreams, and track down the secrets to his empire, and then sell it to a competitor. Cobb needs a crew to pull off these capers, a chemist, a fixer, a forger, and an architect to build the dream world. Here, DiCaprio tries to recruit the actress Ellen Page to join him, though she's new to his line of work.
Let me ask you a question. You never really remember the beginning of a dream, do you? You always wind up
right in the middle of what's going on.
I guess, yeah.
So how did we end up here?
Well, we just came from the,
Think about it, Ariadne. How did you get here? Where are you right now?
We're dreaming?
You're actually in the middle of the workshop right now, sleeping. This is your first lesson in shared dreaming. Stay calm.
There is, of course, a catch. Dom Cobb was once married. Marion Cotillard plays his former wife, Moll, now a menacing presence in his dreams. I spoke with Leonardo DiCaprio. He told me that before they began shooting, he and director Christopher Nolan spent 2 months together, talking every day, sometimes all day, about the world of the story.
He was very passionate and very focused on creating this emotional, cathartic backstory for Cobb. So that led us to really delve deep into his past, because this story is set in the present, but there's obviously things from his past that keep coming about within the dreamscape that are sabotaging the mission. And we had to really create what that story was, and that led us to both just really creating this backstory of his relationship with Moll, and having, without giving away the ending, having almost lived a full life together. And there's this deeply rooted attachment that he has to her emotionally because of that. And he's been to places that people in the, I guess, the waking world haven't experienced yet. And all that stuff helped really shape not only the course of the character, but the whole movie and tonally what happens at the end, because it, like I said, does become this 2.5-hour psychotherapy session.
Did it feel like that when you were working on it?
Very, very much so. You know, I use that word existential, but I've really never had conversations with other actors about scenes like I had on this film, in particular with Marion Cotillard, who's incredible to work with, because not only is she an extremely talented actress, but she was really game for these types of sort of strange philosophical conversations about how to play a scene where I'm in essence talking to my own conscience and she is a manifestation of my own trauma, and I'm face to face with that, but I'm also talking to another character in the film who's in essence my therapist within the dreamscape, and I'm talking to her about my nightmares. But when you look at the movie, it looks like two characters just talking and a third one listening, but it's this whole different set of rules and laws that applied within this insane world that Chris Nolan created.
You know, I don't want to give too much away, but after watching this film, I'm very conscious of falling asleep. It makes me think that I'm going to be very careful about falling asleep on a train or on a moving plane or any place where people might actually see me. And I'm wondering if you had that experience, if you started to really think about and analyze your own dreams in an interesting way.
You know, strangely enough, I'm not a big dreamer at all. I remember,
or so you think.
I have very vivid dreams, and you know, while I'm in them, oftentimes I know that I'm dreaming, and I tell myself to remember some of these sequences when I wake up, and then I usually forget all of them. But I actually had one recently that was really interesting. And it's, I guess, because I've been talking about this damn movie so much, but and doing all this publicity, that I entered the dreamscape and really applied all the rules of Inception and all the ideas that Chris has in this movie to my dream. And I knew I was dreaming, but I also didn't know that I had done this film or I was in a movie about the dreamscape. And I got to manipulate it from being a horrific nightmare into something quite positive. So that was a really interesting experience.
So you accepted the training. You passed.
I accepted the training. I absolutely accepted it.
Many of your recent and what some consider to be your best films, The Aviator, Departed, Revolutionary Road, Shutter Island, and now Inception, are all in one way or another about the mind and a certain kind of madness. Why are you drawn to this kind of material?
Well, certainly with these last two films, I've just been fascinated with the idea of a completely unreliable protagonist, not only to the audience, but to everyone around him. And the idea that somebody could be going on their own inner journey while they're simultaneously trying to figure out some sort of mystery or simultaneously trying to explore a world that they're unfamiliar with just fascinated the hell out of me. I've never really questioned why I'm drawn to a certain piece of material or if I've done a specific type of genre before. I always look at them as unique experiences because I believe as history unfolds, certain films will disappear and certain ones will stand the test of time, and you never know which ones those are. And you just got to go for the opportunities of films that you think might be memorable or might have an emotional impact on people.
Well, I know I have to let you go, but I just have one last quick question. You mentioned something that Dom Cobb experiences things in this film that people in the waking world have never known. He's a man who's isolated in part because he's so good at what he does and for one reason or another just can't go home. It seems like, as a very successful actor, that's something that you might be able to relate to.
I do. You know, it's been interesting having worked in this industry for over 20 years now, being 35 and having started when I was, you know, 13, 14 years old. And I've gotten to go to far-off places in the world, have very unique, isolated, intense experiences for 4 or 5 months at a time. And then, kind of like a dream, those things disappear. You may see those people again, but it's never, ever going to be as intense as it was for that time period. And you are, in essence, kind of living other people's lives. And when you do that, and when you research these characters, and you want to become emotionally invested in them, you have to, in a way, try to channel their feelings and their emotional constraints. So it has been very much like my therapy because I get to go to places that I don't think I normally would in a lot of occurrences because my life has been pretty damn blessed thus far. I've been a pretty lucky man.
Well, we've been lucky to talk to you, Leonardo DiCaprio. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's Leonardo DiCaprio. His latest film is Inception. And you'll find differing opinions of the film from critics Kenneth Turan and David Edelstein. That's at NPR.org. Last week, we heard about the rough road many touring musicians face this summer. According to a new report, gross revenues in North America are down 17% over the first half of 2009. The dip in ticket sales has hit the country's biggest promoter of live music, Live Nation, particularly hard. After its merger with Ticketmaster was approved earlier this year by the Justice Department, many thought Live Nation would become even more powerful. But some in the industry say the company's own business model has caused it to stumble. Jacob Gantz reports.
Seth Hurwitz is a competitor of Live Nation. Hurwitz is a promoter, too. He owns Washington, D.C.'s 930 Club and IMP Productions. He says he's not surprised that some of this summer's tours are flailing.
Sales are down in bad situations, like they should be. But talking about the concert business as a whole, as it relates to the large companies that try to run the whole industry, is a little like asking BP how's the oil business these days.
Those large companies that run the concert industry would be Live Nation and AEG, the promoters who, between them, sold nearly two-thirds of all the concert tickets American audiences bought in 2009. A promoter's job is to take care of everything that doesn't happen on stage, from booking a venue to hiring local labor to taking out ads to making sure all the tickets sell. Traditionally, promoters were middlemen. They'd rent venues and pay touring musicians a percentage of ticket sales. Live Nation, the world's largest promoter, declined to comment for this story. Louis Messina has been a promoter for over 35 years, both as an independent and at large corporations like AEG, which owns his current company, the Messina Group.
You know, I guess if anything, I was the bad guy.
Messina takes credit for an innovation that changed the promotions business.
We made a decision a long time ago because profit margins are so small promoting concerts that we had to get into the building business.
By getting into the building business, Messina means he and his partners began to build amphitheaters. Why? So they wouldn't have to rent someone else's venue, and so they'd pocket all the money concertgoers spend that doesn't show up on a ticket stub.
Whatever they charge for beer, $10 or $15, and parking and all that's really where they're making their money. And so they can almost afford to pay an artist more than what they're getting for ticket sales.
That's Kelly Curtis, the longtime manager of the band Pearl Jam. He says promoters know they'll bring in extra cash from beer and parking, plus advertising and sponsorships at venues they own, so they can pay musicians in advance, before a single ticket is sold. And yes, sometimes at a rate higher than what they'd bring in, even if they sold every seat.
The concert promotion business is more voodoo art than it is science.
Gary Bongiovanni is the editor-in-chief of Polestar, a publication that tracks the concert industry.
There is a substantial chance in every case that you're going to lose money potentially, and the bigger the star, the more money you're having to guarantee, thus the greater risk you're taking.
Expand to a huge scale and you've got the Live Nation model. It owns a majority share of Frontline, a company that manages many major artists, and it also owns most of the amphitheaters around the country. That means when summer rolls around, it can set up entire tours where its artists play exclusively in its venues. The problem is, it's built a nationwide string of beach houses, and it has to keep them filled all summer.
The temptation during the summer months is to buy as many shows as possible to keep that activity level up in their venues. And they may well be buying some shows that they should have passed on.
Shows that this summer aren't selling, says Bongiovanni. When this happens, promoters can cut their losses and cancel concerts. Last week, dates on the Rihanna and Lilith Fair tours joined shows by the Eagles and Jonas Brothers, along with entire tours by Christina Aguilera and Limp Bizkit on this summer's Chopping Block. They can also reduce ticket prices to try and put bodies in seats, hoping that beer sales will help make up for some of the shortfall. Louis Messina, who put together two of the top five tours of the year so far, according to Polestar's mid-year report, says that's bad business.
Whenever you have to back into a ticket price because you pay too much for an artist, it's a broken model.
For promoters and fans, says Gary Bongiovanni.
Nothing makes a fan more disappointed than to have bought a ticket when they first went on sale at full price to find out other people are getting in for $10.
All of this, says Seth Hurwitz, takes the fun out of the concert-going experience.
Buying a band for the entire country is treating it like it's product. And although it's product in that, you know, yeah, we're all trying to make money at this. You know, if you treat the country and if you treat everyone like it's product, well, that's how they're going to treat you.
Hurwitz, who is an independent promoter unaffiliated with either AEG or Live Nation, says that everyone involved, from promoters to venues to bands and their managers, is responsible for making sure that going to a concert is a good experience for the fan, even if that means making a little less money. Louis Messina booked Taylor Swift's tour last year. He says that's exactly what she did.
We could have sold tickets for $150 and sold out everywhere across the country. Our first tour, the Fearless One tour, ticket price was $49.50.
Unless ticket sales start to turn around, that's a reality that everyone in the industry might have to get used to. For NPR News, I'm Jacob Gans.
Here's a story about another Scotsman influenced by American culture. For 2 years, Gavin Bain posed as an American rapper, and he managed to get a major label record deal out of it. In 1999, he saw an ad for an open audition with a well-known UK record label called Polydor, and it asked, "Are you the next Eminem?" Now, Bain and his friend Billy Boyd thought they were, so they hopped on a bus to prove it. And the story of what happened next is told by Gavin Bain in his new memoir. It's called California Scheming.
When we arrived, you know, it's a 13-hour bus journey down to London from Dundee, so we were pretty tired, and we just went straight to the audition, and there was a queue right up the street, you know, like,
wow.
There was, I don't know, 10, 15 blocks, it was just mammoth, absolutely mammoth. We kind of just joined the back, and we battle-rapped our way, skipping the queue right to the front. Eventually, we come across the, I guess you can call them judges, right?
Right.
In this day and age.
You start rapping for them.
Yeah, just started doing one of our songs, and they were just kind of laughing. they just started laughing. Within about 30 seconds, it was like someone laced the room with nitrous oxide. They were just like, nah, that's not going to work. You sound like the Rapping Proclaimers.
Like the Rapping Proclaimers.
Yeah.
The Scottish band, of course, the Proclaimers.
Yeah.
Best known for 500 miles.
I will walk 500
right.
miles, yeah.
Right.
So we were not walking. We were taking a bus a few hundred miles back up to Dundee.
So you guys go back to Dundee, you're crestfallen, and then you guys come up with a plan to actually make it as American rappers. First of all, why did you decide to do that?
we didn't really make the plan until I saw The Secret of My Success, you know, that old classic 80s
movie? Oh, yeah,
it was
Michael J. Fox.
Michael J. Fox. Right. And you know his character, Carlton, you know, gets into this company and he basically cons his way that he's an executive, all that he wants to get to the top. And then at the end, it all comes clean and it's a happy ending. And I just think, why don't we do that? We can throw on American accents, you know, and we were really into acting and playing parts, so we could play characters and then get in the door, and as soon as if we got a record deal and if we got a record out, then we can come out clean on like a TV show and say, look, we were never American and this is our story. For us, that would explain everything, that would inspire young Scottish artists and artists over the world to, you know, keep going if they were ever turned down. I like to take you right back to my school days. Used to fall asleep in class with some dude with time and shoelace. Never
went to college, yeah, I dropped out. You know, we used to give a damn, but I forgot how. So you guys came up with this elaborate backstory. What was it?
We didn't really know much about American
culture.
You'd never
been to America, right?
No, I'd never ever been. Billy had cousins in Hemet, California. So the backstory basically was we were raised in Hemet. We were, you know, badasses at school. We always got kicked out of school. Our dad worked in insurance. We, you know, we started saying that actually at a certain age we moved to Huntington Beach. we were battle rapping at the Vans Warped Tour in 96. We were at Scribble Jam in 97. And, you know, all these events happened.
And they happened, you know, in the U.S., obviously.
Yeah, in the U.S. So we were just kind of saying we were at them, and that's where we got noticed doing this. And eventually that we just came on tour, and when we got to the U.K., we ran out of cash, and so now we're trying to make it over here.
If I was interviewing Brains McLeod right now, and I didn't know that you were an American, what would you sound like?
Look, guy, I'm not liking this interview. Why don't you put your boss on? I'm not talking to you anymore. I'm getting tired of this. I'm in control here, you're not. Put your boss on the phone.
So that's basically what you started to do. You started to speak that way. So you started to work on the scheme. It took you about 2 years to get it down. How did you end up getting an audition with a major label in London?
The first weekend that we were in London, we blagged our way onto a show. We called up a promoter and said, look, you've got to give us this show. American accent, of course, now. And we just said, look, if we're on this bill, then it's going to be an amazing show. You need to have us on that bill. And we convinced the guy to put us on one of the headline slots. This was the kind of moment, you know, of deciding, this is it. We're going to stay in character. And as soon as we went on stage that night, the performance never stopped. Afterwards, there's a guy there from Island Records, and he comes up and he says, those words, where are you guys from? And we were just like, oh, Christ, there's no turning back now. So we went through our backstory. Yeah, we're from Hemet, California. Dad works in insurance. Mom, you know, neighborhood watch and works with the church. You know, yeah, we got kicked out of school. And then tell the backstory. And then straight after that, it's like, okay, cool. We'll come to my office tomorrow morning and we'll talk and we'll go from there.
So you ended up signing with Sony UK.
Sony UK, yeah.
You signed a deal with them as American rappers.
As American rappers.
And a deal worth about $350,000.
Yeah, if you do the conversion, yeah. I mean, in the end, I mean, when you add the amount of endorsements on top of everything, you know, tour support, record support, we eventually recorded 3 albums worth of music.
I'm speaking with Scottish musician Gavin Bain. He's the author of California Schemin', the story of how for 2 years he pretended to be an American rapper. Gavin Bain, when did it all start to crumble? I mean, this lasted for 2 years.
We never knew it was going to last that long. It just got carried away. There was so much money involved. The plan was originally to come out, but then as soon as we wanted to release the record, we realized that if the record came out and there was anything different that compromised the sales of the record, we stood to be sued.
In other words, your contract said that if you guys misrepresented yourself, you would be held liable.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Eventually, the lies we were caught up in just kept, you know, I don't know how much more we could have taken, but it was more down to the personal relationships that Bill and I had, that we were best friends And now we were at each other's throats every night. The drinking and the drugs and everything had just gone so far. We blamed each other for it. And eventually, we couldn't come out of character. At first, we had to stop talking to our parents and our friends back home because it was hard to stay in character. But at this point, we were so in character, so in love with these characters, we couldn't get out of the character. It was complete insanity.
He decided that he wanted none of this anymore. He wanted to get out of this and left.
Yeah, we had a pretty bad fight when he told me that he was going to go back and marry his girlfriend up in Scotland. And I just thought, you know, I hate giving in. I couldn't quit. So we had a massive fight. And to be honest, we nearly killed each other. Once you have a fight like that, there's just no real way of coming back. So I guess, you know, when I went to the store the next day to get some breakfast, to make some breakfast and kind of apologize, and when I came back, he was gone.
You continued to sort of live on as Brains McLeod for about 2 more years, right?
Yeah, in total it was 5 years that I was in character of Brains McLeod. And for me, I still thought this American character I was playing, it was more beneficial to be him than me. That's how little I thought of myself and how much I thought of this Brains character. It was me playing my greatest hero. And why would I want to end him, you know? But not realizing that he'd caused all these problems. It was him, you know, and actually the good stuff was actually just me. It was me playing it, you know?
Are you still in contact with Billy Boyd?
We've tried to kind of put our friendship back together, and that's kind of where it's at now. We haven't gone any further than that. we're talking on Facebook.
Did people react badly when you eventually confessed? Did they think you betrayed them?
Some did. Some didn't understand it. Some thought it was incredible. Some laughed. Some slapped me. It was really mixed. But I have regrets about certain things. I mean, anyone who doesn't have regrets probably is a bit naive and doesn't really, you know, realize what they've done. But I know that the message of what I was trying to do was good. And everything I'm doing now is good. And the book and the movie and everything that I'm doing, the music, it's all to convey one message, and that message is just be sure of yourself, never give up. That was what it was supposed to prove.
That's Gavin Bain. For nearly 5 years, he pretended to be an American rapper under the pseudonym Brains McLeod. His book about the experience is called California Schemin'. Gavin Bain, thanks so much.
No, it's been my pleasure.
And Gavin Bain is still making music without the fake accent. His new band is called Hopeless Heroic. This is a confessional song. It's called The Getaway.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Netta Ulaby. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.